4122 Northeast Sandy Boulevard in Portland. More information is available at kboo.fm on the right side of the homepage under Community Events.
The 18th Annual Homelessness Marathon Broadcast, a national town hall discussion on poverty and homelessness in America.
I think it would be pretty startling for the majority of the public to know that within about two blocks from the White House itself, there are homeless people sleeping in parks.
This year, we'll be live from the streets of Washington, D.C. That's the Homelessness Marathon Broadcast, coming to you soon and heard right here on this radio station.
This station is KBOO Portland. Hear the Homelessness Marathon live beginning at 5 p.m. Wednesday, February 17th, and continuing until 6 a.m. Thursday morning.
Welcome to Book Waves. I'm Richard Walensky. My guest is Pamela Rottner Sakamoto, whose book is titled Midnight in Broad Daylight, A Japanese-American Family Caught Between Two Worlds. This is your first book?
It's my first trade book. I have one academic book, Japanese Diplomats and Jewish Refugees, A World War II Dilemma. And it's about the rescue by a Japanese diplomat of Polish Jews during World War II.
Pamela Rottner Sakamoto works at the Ponohu School in Honolulu and is an expert consultant on Japan-related projects for the Holocaust Memorial Museum, which I guess is what that book is about.
It's connected, yes.
Yeah. This particular book, Midnight in Broad Daylight, it began when you met Harry Fukuhara in 1994. What happened?
I was living in Tokyo. I had just moved there, and I attended a press conference for actually these former Jewish refugees who were visiting Japan for the first time in 50 years. I was really just at the dissertation stage at that point, and I went to hear their stories. I saw this Japanese-American gentleman circulating, and I was so impressed by him, but I didn't think too much about it. I eventually said to a filmmaker with the group, these refugees' stories are amazing. I'm so glad I'm hearing them. And she said, if you think their stories are incredible, you should talk to Harry. He welcomed me aboard as a graduate student. We didn't talk about his story at all. I continued to be impressed by his dignity, his poise, his bilingual capabilities. But what happened was that when we said goodbye, he corresponded with me, and he was living in San Jose, and he would come to Tokyo several times a year, and he would call me for lunch. And over the course of 4 years, he told me his story little by little. And finally, we were both very busy, but I said to him, you know, Harry, this is really remarkable, and I think you should consider leaving a record. It would be so meaningful for your family, for your generation, for U.S.-Japan relations, and if you would consider having me do it, I'd be delighted to, but it doesn't have to be me. It can be somebody else, but please think about it. And the next day, he introduced me to his brothers, and we were off and running.
So at that point, you met Pierce and Frank.
Yes.
And Pierce and Frank, the two brothers, they were living in Japan.
Yes, they had stayed in Japan for their entire lives at that point, other than the time that they were raised outside of Seattle. They had left Seattle in 1933 when their dad had died and their mother had taken everybody back, and they were the ones who were in the Japanese Imperial Army.
The bulk of the book is Harry and Frank was basically your guide in Japan. So as you were traveling around, he just told you stuff, right?
Yes. I mean, he was so game for this project. First, I think it comes back to his relationship with his brother Harry. From the time that they were born and Frank was 4 years younger than Harry, Frank really worshipped Harry. Whatever happened, that didn't seem to change. And so when Harry said that he wanted to do this project, Frank was determined that he would really be Harry's substitute. When Harry was back in California, Frank would do it. But of course, he had his own perspective, which was so fascinating. And he shared things with me that Harry could not have known.
What happens is that Harry is in America during the war, and Frank is in Japan. Pierce was around then, so there's a little bit of Pierce, but not that much Pierce in the book. Same with Mary, the sister who stayed in America. Did you spend much time with either of them?
Since it's nonfiction, you really have to use your sources accurately and with great care. Pierce was an introvert by nature. He was very cooperative, very kind. He introduced me to my dentist in Tokyo, but he literally put his own life story on a cocktail napkin. And Mary actually had such a complicated relationship with her mother that she was not able to resolve until even at the end of her life. Towards the end of her life, because she had never talked to her mother and come to terms with their fractured relationship, she was actually depressed. And I had to wait for an opportunity to see her when she would be willing to talk. And I was given the green light by her daughter, and I flew to Los Angeles, and I had two wonderful interviews with her, but it was a briefer relationship.
The other two main characters in your book are their mother, Kinu, and their aunt, Kyo. Now, both of them were gone. They had both died when you began the project. Is that correct?
That's correct.
But you were able to get a lot of that information from someone named Masako?
Yes. So Frank was always ready to take a trip and meet people who had known his family. And we were in Hiroshima. We were walking down the street to the family's home. Only one owner has owned the home since the family lived there. They purchased it with all its furniture, and they have kept it like a museum, so it's just a precious place to visit. But we were en route to that house, and we heard somebody call Frank's name, and we turned it around, and it was Frank and Kinu's former neighbor, Masako, who had been away for many years while her husband was transferred here and there and was now back. And she had not talked to anybody about the experiences, but she had viewed Kinu as a mother. Her own mother had died, and she was with Kinu on the day of the atomic bomb, and she was so ready to share, and she had a very good memory, so it was quite wonderful to meet her.
Pamela Rottner Sakamoto, the entire story of this family, the Fukuhara family, is in essence, I guess, the Japanese story of the 20th century. As you were approaching it, did you feel overwhelmed by what you wanted to accomplish? How did you mold this enormous story in shape? Because you did an amazing amount of research.
Well, I struggled for a long time. What kind of story should this be? Initially, because Harry was so legendary in the United States Army and in the military intelligence service, he rose to become one of the first Japanese-American colonels and a real bridge between the two countries in the aftermath of the war. People would assume that I was writing a biography of him and a military history, but that was never my intention, and I'm not a military historian. I really wanted to share Frank's and Mary's and Victor, the eldest brother's, stories and their moms, all of these wonderful characters. And it was a place and point in time that no longer exists. I wanted to capture Hiroshima. And so I worked at it as a chronology. I did a lot of outside research, a lot of general research, then narrowed in and interviewed for years and years and sort of let it grow organically and then tried to shape it in a natural way as well.
The story of Harry is a story that we've heard before from people like George Takei and others. The story of Frank, though, is different. Here's a man, a boy, who lived part of his life in the U.S. and winds up in Japan and went to school there. When he was telling you about his school days, what was your reaction to that? Because he got beat up a lot.
Well, as a mother of a child who was roughly Frank's age when I was interviewing him, and a child who was living in Japan and biracial and had dual nationality but was treated as a foreigner, I could really connect on an emotional level, although my son, of course, was raised during peacetime, and it is a different story. But here is Frank, who was ethnically Japanese, and yet he was targeted because he was Japanese-American. Frank shared that with me. He had not told anybody in his family. He had never even told Harry, because it was such a searing experience for him to be mercilessly bullied on the basis of his background, which in our day and age was something to celebrate.
He's also something called a kibe, which we don't really hear about. The Issei are those who came over and stayed. The Nisei are the ones who were born here, Japanese Americans. But the kibe are the ones who were either born here or grew up here and then went back to Japan. There were a lot of them, and that would have put them in a very peculiar position in World War II.
Absolutely. And there are so many people I meet who say to me now, oh my goodness, that was the same kind of situation as my family. My auntie went over to Japan for some of her schooling. Then she was caught there during the war. And there are so many people in the United States whose ancestors hail from Hiroshima Prefecture. It was one of the major departure points for the United States, in part because it was impoverished.
Hiroshima, I didn't realize this, was basically not bombed during the war. They kept it pristine, which must have been very strange and okay for the people there, but then what happened, you know?
Well, the anxiety was mounting for them. They didn't know that it was being preserved, and so they felt, you know, when is our turn coming? More than 60 major cities were being bombed repeatedly in Japan by the Allies at that point. So people in Hiroshima were on edge. They were going to bed fully dressed. They were accustomed to air raid sirens. They just were waiting for a massive raid to come.
Pamela Rottner Sakamoto, one aspect that we don't know about is what was Hiroshima like prior to the bomb, because it was completely leveled. And it was a fairly typical Japanese city, except that it was also kind of a entry point for the military.
Yes, I mean, it was a good-sized Japanese city, and it had been historically a departure point for Japanese Imperial Army troops heading to China. So it was quite accustomed to military activity. And so you're right, it's sort of strange that it hadn't been bombed.
Harry has an enemy in elementary school who winds up in the Japanese Army, and they wind up meeting peculiarly during the war. Had you considered kind of examining his story a little further? Because it's the only story we have of what it was actually like in the Army. Victor, Pierce, and Frank never went overseas.
Oh, good point. Well, I met Mr. Matsuda. That's the man who had this contentious relationship. He had beaten up Harry. Matsuda, I met three times, and I corresponded with him. And he was really changed by the war. He had been in the Japanese Army for a long time. He had been in many places in the Pacific. He was a hardened man. He did not respect his commanders. He did not like going to different reunions that still were taking place. He had struggled to reacclimate to civilian life when he had returned to Japan. I think I got as much as he was able to give. He shared photos. He shared his recollections of his relationship with Harry and their encounter, but he was so dismissive of his experience.
What about the way that he treated Harry? Did he have remorse for it?
No, that's really interesting. He was a bully. This was what he did. He beat up other people at whim. Harry took it very personally. Harry felt that this man was targeting him because he was Japanese American. Matsuda's son did not really remember it that way. But there is an element of that, because Matsuda thought that Harry sort of carried himself arrogantly. And it's true that Japanese Americans carried themselves. They walked and talked, even if they were totally bilingual, in a different manner than Japanese. They gave themselves away easily. Matsuda was irritated by Harry, and that was enough. But he felt that because they had fought, that bred intimacy. It was a form of touch, a caress of sorts, although it was violent. And when he came across Harry, they came across each other in New Guinea, he realized that he would never have remembered Harry otherwise. They would have just been passing each other by. And he felt that Harry saved his life. Harry expedited his medical care. He was an emaciated prisoner of war. And Harry actually checked on his parents, which helped Matsuda go back to Hiroshima. And for the rest of his life, Matsuda was grateful to Harry.
You're listening to an interview with Pamela Ratna Sakamoto, whose book is titled Midnight in Broad Daylight, A Japanese-American Family Caught Between Two Worlds. I'm Richard Walensky on Bookwaves. We hear a little bit about the 100th Infantry Battalion of Japanese-Americans in Europe, but we don't hear that much until Midnight in Broad Daylight about the 6,000 Japanese who served in military intelligence during the war and in the occupation. Was this something new to you, too?
It was. When I started the project, I did not know anything. And this is one of those overlooked aspects of history. The military intelligence service was established on an ad hoc basis to respond to the needs for intelligence in the Pacific when the Japanese were on the offensive. It was a top secret unit. Soldiers took a vow of secrecy. The United States did not want the Japanese to know that Japanese American bilingual linguists were reading their reports that they left behind and thought were impenetrable. Because this unit was sort of attached to existing military units, they were never really recognized as being independent.
And on top of that, these Japanese soldiers in the American Army had to have guards to make sure that they weren't killed.
Yes, they needed bodyguards because the risk of friendly fire was so great.
When Harry was here, he was experiencing tremendous racism. That was even before the war. Did he talk about how much or whether it improved or how it improved or when it improved after the war?
Initially, when he returned to California in 1946, the situation had not improved. Just because the war was over did not mean that people wiped their prejudices away. He found it very rough and very disappointing. But over time, and I'm talking decades, he did see an improvement. When he finally retired from the United States Army in 1990, after almost 50 years of service, he did become a tireless volunteer. He would go to speak to all kinds of groups, students and community centers and museums, you name it, to talk about what happened and to keep the story alive. But so many of his colleagues still kept that vow of secrecy and did not talk about their experiences. He would not be surprised by what's happening in the political arena right now. He would be disappointed, but not surprised.
About his feelings toward the prejudice, I mean, he passed away a year ago, so he would have seen some of the anti-Muslim sentiment now, right?
After 9/11, there was a rash of anti-Muslim sentiment, and he was right out there with the Japanese-American community. The Japanese-American National Museum was one of the first groups to raise its hand and say, this is wrong, remember what happened to us, you are scapegoating and targeting an innocent population. And Harry was part of that group, and also he lived in San Jose, so he's in Northern California, and he was with the Japanese-American Historical Society, and going to speak to all sorts of groups. So he was aware of that. When he died in April of 2015, he was not aware of what was happening and what happened with the election now.
You did the research. What was the single most surprising thing that you found?
Actually, that's a hard question because I had so many surprises along the way. In the big picture, the longer I worked on the project and I tried to get to the heart of the story, to do all the research but then get to the essence of what was going on with this family, I was astonished and humbled and inspired by Harry's utter lack of bitterness over what had happened when he was interned and then what had happened with the atomic bomb.
And what was the most shocking thing?
the atomic bomb, what happened to Harry's brother, Victor, and what happened to loved ones who, these were people, well, Victor could not share his story. Victor died in 1947 from his wounds, but there were people who had survived the bomb who had never been interviewed before, and they shared the graphic nature of that day and their illnesses. Yes, I mean, it leaves you speechless.
Chaco was a woman that was at Hiroshima. Did you talk to her?
Yes. I went with Frank and had the most wonderful visit with her. She was living in Fukuoka at that point with a daughter. She lived in this small, simple, sunlit home that was just immaculately clean. It was filled with these delicate paper dolls that she made, and she had never talked about her experiences. She had been ill for many years after the bomb. She considered suicide. She had recovered. She had married, which was difficult for atomic bomb survivors because they were stigmatized. She had two daughters, and she had become happy. And she made me two of those paper dolls with Japanese washi rice paper. And they sit in my home. They're among my most treasured possessions today.
You say that they were stigmatized. That's something I didn't know.
Yes. I mean, for a young woman in her 20s, it would be very hard for her to marry because the belief was that almost as if her illnesses were contagious, that aspect, and then that genetically, whatever she had experienced could be passed on to her children. Her children are fine.
The entire Fukuhara family would have been affected by this because they were there.
Well, Frank and Pierce were on the southern island of Kyushu. They were Japanese imperial soldiers, and they were waiting for the expected onslaught of an Allied invasion, which was slated for fall of 1945 until the bombs were dropped. And Mary was back in the United States, but Kinu, the mother, and Kyo, her sister, and Victor, and a bunch of cousins and neighbors and friends, including Chieko and Masako, yes, they were all within range. It depended upon how close they were to the epicenter.
Pierce and Frank got home, though, within a couple of weeks, I would think, after the bomb. Is that correct?
It took a while because Frank, in particular, wasn't even told that the war had ended. He was just sort of handed some pay, back pay, and told that he was free to go. It was only when he was on the train home to Hiroshima that he heard people talking about this new kind of bomb. When he got back, his mother and brother were already ill, and that's when he really discovered what had happened.
And Pierce?
Pierce came around the same time as Frank, within a few days to a week of each other, and they just, both of them, worked to get the family back on their feet. Their mother and brother were ailing. They needed people to go buy them food, people to be able to purchase food, and inflation was skyrocketing. Frank and Pierce were actually able to use their English, which was incredibly rusty because they'd been back in Japan from 1933 and now it's 1945, and they had suppressed their American identities and their English for so long. But they dusted it off and they were able to serve as interpreters. And so Frank was accompanying the Atomic Bomb Survey Commission, which was trying to find out where the precise epicenter was. And he was going into people's homes and asking, you know, these terribly ill residents, may we ask you some questions about that day? He was being paid very handsomely, which was helpful for the family. Frank and Pierce were in demand, but it was a time of anguish.
Pamela Rottner Sakamoto, there's a lot of debate about whether the bomb needed to be dropped at all. Could they have just done a demonstration off Tokyo Bay? And if it dropped on Hiroshima, did they need to drop another one on Nagasaki? The sense I get from Midnight in Broad Daylight is that the United States had to make such a strong statement to the Japanese because otherwise they would never, ever have surrendered and would have been home-to-home combat.
Yes. I mean, I try not to come down politically either way. I try to present both sides' perspectives and let the reader decide. And it's still a very controversial topic among historians, and I don't see any end to it, whether or not the United States should have dropped the bombs, particularly the second one. But yes, in the case of Hiroshima, I think that how you've characterized it is correct. Harry did not believe that the Japanese would surrender. He was telling his commanding officers that. Frank did not believe that the Japanese would surrender, and he was prepared to die in a suicide squad for one of his nations.
So the fact that when Hirohito caved, that was kind of astonishing for many Japanese, which is not something that we hear about. They were kind of going, hey, what?
Yes, they weren't really prepared for that. Here, Japan is in a complete shambles. From the firebombings alone, there are millions homeless. More than 60 cities are decimated. And then you have Hiroshima and Nagasaki brought to their knees with these frightening repercussions. And yet people didn't know what would follow. And no one had even heard the emperor's voice. He was a divine person. To hear his voice crackle over the airwaves and basically say that the war was over left people bereft, overjoyed, empty, questioning all sorts of reactions.
In writing the story of the four surviving siblings, it becomes fairly easy to make them close third person because you're talking to them. You get information out of them. You could ask follow-ups. But you also kind of do that with Kinu and Aunt Kyo.
Well, I talked to so many people, so many relatives and friends of Kyo and Kinu, and talked to them repeatedly, so I was able to check their stories and ask more detailed questions, that at a certain point I felt I had enough corroboration that I could say, for example, that Kinu missed Terry terribly when he was in the United States and did not want any of her sons in any army. Nevertheless, they would all end up in different armies.
Writing the section on the bomb and the aftermath in Hiroshima must have been difficult, because reading it is difficult.
It was. It was really hard. I had to immerse myself in that period when I was writing that chapter. And every day I had to take a deep breath and sit down and grapple with it, because it's tragic.
What year did you actually finish the book?
I finished the manuscript that I submitted to the publisher. Well, I finished the manuscript that I wrote, and then I prepared a proposal for the publisher. So I finished the manuscript in 2012. And then there's been a hiatus.
So in that period, you and Harry and Frank were all expecting to see it in print before they died, and they didn't.
No, I mean, Harry died at 95, and Frank was about 90, 91. So they had long, really full lives. I actually did lose a lot of sleep over the course of this story about the prospect, because of their ages, that they might not see the book in print. But ultimately, I came to terms with the realization that they had led incredibly gratifying lives post-war. They loved each other. They loved their families. Professionally, they were extremely successful. Harry was one of the first Japanese-American colonels in the U.S. Army. In December of 2015, the 500th Military Intelligence Brigade at Schofield Barracks, which was strafed by Japanese Zeros on the day of the Pearl Harbor attack, dedicated its permanent brand new headquarters to Harry Fukuhara. And that is just such a statement of his value to the United States. So at some point I came to terms with the idea that they didn't need this book. This was extra for them. They had such a great sense of self. They wanted to get the story out there, and they knew that it would happen even if they weren't here.
You kind of got people just at the tail end when you could, because this book could never be written today.
Yes, it's a moment in time. I feel incredibly fortunate that they opened their lives to me, and I don't think it could be written again.
Can we take anything away from this other than understanding the nature of prejudice?
I hope we can learn that we should always try to relate on a human level, not to just look at the big picture, what kind of animosity is occurring at a national level, and think about the human beings on the other side and tamp down that bitterness.
You've been listening to an interview with Pamela Rottner Sakamoto, whose book is titled Midnight in Broad Daylight, A Japanese-American Family Caught Between Two Worlds. I'm Richard Walensky on Bookwaves. For more information about this show, go to bookwaves.com, where you'll also find an extended version of this interview. Bookwaves is produced by Richard Walensky in the studios of KPFA Pacifica Radio in Berkeley, California.
KABU Community Radio is a proud sponsor of the We Real Cool film series at the Clinton Street Theater. The film this month is A Streetcar Named Desire, showing Thursday, February 18th at 7 p.m. Winner of 5 Academy Awards and considered the first dramatic jazz score of a film, 1951's A Streetcar Named Desire remains a landmark which forced the medium into a new, raw, emotional, mature kind of expression. Again, that's A Streetcar Named Desire, Thursday, February 18th, 7 p.m. at the Clinton Street Theater, 2522 Southeast Clinton Street in Portland. More information can be found at kboo.fm on the right side of the homepage under Community Events.
Help us celebrate the 10-year anniversary of the Confessional Radio Show with Contessa de la Luna. We have performances by Contessa de la Luna herself, Remy Fasolatido, Mike Crenshaw, and many more. We have plenty of audience participation, including Human Shadow Puppet Theater, Animal Impersonation Contests, and prizes, prizes, prizes. And don't miss our David Bowie Kazoo Tribute. All that and more, Thursday, February 11th, 7 to 9:30 p.m. at the Clinton Street Theater. Tickets are $10 for an entire night of music, mayhem, laughs, and surprises. All proceeds benefit KABU Community Radio. Tickets available now in advance at brownpapertickets.com or at the door. Join us Thursday, February 11th, 7 to 9:30 p.m. at the Clinton Street Theater. See you there.
Just a quick news update from the KABU newsroom. The last of the occupiers at the Malheur Refuge has surrendered. David Fry surrendered to the FBI just before 11 a.m.